another heir, a proper heir. Wylan had become expendable. He would vanish from the city, take up occupation elsewhere. Time would pass, and no one would raise a brow when Alice's child was groomed to be the head of the Vanek Empire. As long as it takes people to forget I had a son. That hadn't been an idle insult. Migson and Pryor arrived at 8 bells to see Wylan to the boat. No one came to say a last goodbye, and when he'd walked past his father's office, the door was closed. Wylan refused to knock and plead for a scrap of affection like Alice's terrier begging for treats. His father's men wore the dark suits favored by merchants and said little to Wylan on the walk over to the dock. They purchased tickets for the Belent line, and once they were aboard the boat, Migson had buried his head in a newspaper while Pryor leaned back in his seat, hat tilted downward, lids not quite closed. Wylan couldn't be sure if the man was sleeping or staring at him like some kind of drowsy-eyed lizard. The boat was nearly empty at that hour. People dozed in the stuffy cabin or ate whatever dinner they'd packed, ham rolls and insulated flasks of coffee balanced on their laps. Unable to sleep, Wylan had left the heat of the cabin and walked to the prow of the boat. The winter air was cold and smelled of the slaughterhouses on the outskirts of the city. It turned Wyland's stomach, but soon the lights would fade and they'd be in the open country. He was sorry they weren't traveling by day. He would have liked to see the windmills keeping watch over their fields, the sheep grazing in their pastures. He sighed, shivering in his coat, and adjusted the strap of his satchel. He should try to rest. Maybe he could wake up early and watch the sunrise. When he turned, Pryor and Migson were standing behind him. "Sorry," Wylan said. "I..." And then Pryor's hands were tight around his throat. Wylan gasped, or he tried to. The sound that came from him was barely a croak. He clawed at Pryor's wrists, but the man's grip was like iron, the pressure relentless. He was big enough that Wylan could feel himself being lifted slightly as Pryor pushed him against the railing. Pryor's face was dispassionate, nearly bored, and Wylan understood then that he would never reach the school in Belent. He'd never been meant to. There was no secretary, no account in his name. No one was expecting his arrival. The supposed enrollment papers in his pocket might say anything at all. Wylan hadn't even bothered to try to read them. He was going to disappear, just as his father had always wanted, and he'd hired these men to do the job. His father, who had read him to sleep at night, who'd brought him sweet mallow tea and honeycomb when he'd been sick with lung fever. "As long as it takes people to forget I had a son." His father was going to erase him from the ledger, a mistaken calculation, a cost that could be expunged. The tally would be made right. Black spots filled Wylan's vision. He thought he could hear music.
"You there! What's going on?"
The voice seemed to come from a great distance. Pryor's grip loosened very slightly. Wylan's toes made contact with the deck of the boat.
"Nothing at all," said Migson,
turning to face the stranger.
"We just caught this fellow looking through the other passengers' belongings."
Wylan made a choked sound.
Shall I fetch the Stad Watch, then? There are 2 officers in the cabin."
"We've already alerted the captain," said Migson. "We'll be dropping him at the Stad Watch post at the next stop."
"Well, I'm glad you fellows were being so vigilant." The man turned to go. The boat lurched slightly. Weiland wasn't going to wait to see what happened next. He shoved against Pryor with all his might. Then, before he could lose his nerve, he dove over the side of the boat and into the murky canal. He swam with every bit of speed he could muster. He was still dizzy, and his throat ached badly. To his shock, he heard another splash and knew one of the men had dived in after him. If Weiland showed up somewhere still breathing, Migson and Pryor probably wouldn't get paid. He changed his stroke, making as little noise as possible, and forced himself to think. Instead of heading straight to the side of the canal, the way his freezing body longed to, he dove under a nearby market barge and came up on its other side, swimming along with it, using it as cover. The dead weight of his satchel pulled hard at his shoulders, but he couldn't make himself relinquish it. "My things," he thought nonsensically. "My flute." He didn't stop, not even when his breathing grew ragged and his limbs started to turn numb. He forced himself to drive onward, to put as much distance as he could between himself and his father's thugs. But eventually, his strength started to give out, and he realized he was doing more thrashing than swimming. If he didn't get to shore, he would drown. He paddled toward the shadows of a bridge and dragged himself from the canal, then huddled, soaked and shaking in the icy cold. His bruised throat scraped each time he swallowed, and he was terrified that every splash he heard was Pryor coming to finish the job. He needed to make some kind of plan, but it was hard to form whole thoughts. He checked his trouser pockets. He still had the Kruger his father had given him tucked safely away. Though the cash was wet through, it was perfectly good for spending. But where was Weiland supposed to go? He didn't have enough money to get out of the city, and if his father sent men looking for him, he'd be easily tracked. He needed to get somewhere safe, someplace his father wouldn't think to look. His limbs felt weighted with lead, the cold giving way to fatigue. He was afraid that if he let himself close his eyes, he wouldn't have the will to open them again. In the end, he'd simply started walking. He wandered north through the city, away from the slaughterhouses, past a quiet residential area where lesser tradesmen lived, then onward, the streets becoming more crooked and more narrow, until the houses seemed to crowd in on him. Despite the late hour, there were lights in every window and shopfront. Music spilled out of run-down cafes, and he glimpsed bodies pressed up against each other in the alleys.
"Someone dunk you, lad?"
called an old man with a shortage of teeth from a stoop.
"I'll give him a good dunking," crowed a woman, leaning on the stairs.
He was in the barrel. Weiland had lived his whole life in Ketterdam, but he'd never come here. He'd never been allowed to. He'd never wanted to. His father called it a filthy den of vice and blasphemy and the shame of the city. Weiland knew it was a warren of dark streets and hidden passages, a place where locals donned costumes and performed unseemly acts, where foreigners crowded the thoroughfares seeking vile entertainments, where people came and went like tides. The perfect place to disappear. And it had been, until the day the first of his father's letters had arrived. With a start, Weiland realized Jesper was pulling at his sleeve.
"This is our stop, Merchling. Look lively."
Weiland hurried after him. They disembarked at the empty dock at Olendal and walked up the embankment to a sleepy village road. Jesper looked around.
"This place reminds me of home. Fields as far as the eye can see, quiet, broken by nothing but the hum of bees, fresh air."
He shuddered.
"Disgusting."
As they walked, Jesper helped him gather wildflowers from the side of the road. By the time they'd made it to the main street, he had a respectable little bunch.
"I guess we need to find a way to the quarry," Jesper said.
Wyland coughed.
"No, we don't. Just a general store.
But you told Kaz the mineral, it's present in all kinds of paints and enamels. I wanted to make sure I had a reason to go to Olendal."
"Wyland Van Eck, you lied to Kaz Brekker." Jesper clutched a hand to his chest.
"And you got away with it. Do you give lessons?"
Wyland felt ridiculously pleased, until he thought about Kaz finding out. Then he felt a little like the first time he'd tried brandy and ended up spewing his dinner all over his own shoes. They located a general store halfway up the main street, and it took them only a few moments to purchase what they needed. On the way out, a man loading up a wagon exchanged a wave with them.
"You boys looking for work?" he asked skeptically. "Neither of you looks up to a full day in the field."
"You'd be surprised," said Jesper. "We signed on to do some work out near St. Hilda."
Wyland waited, nervous, but the man just nodded.
"You doing repairs at the hospital?"
"Yup," Jesper said easily.
"Your friend there don't talk much."
"Shoo," said Jesper with a shrug.
The older man gave him some kind of grunt in agreement and said,
"Hop on in. I'm going out to the quarry. I can take you to the gates."
"What are the flowers for?"
"He has a sweetheart out near St. Hilda."
"Some sweetheart? I'll say. He has terrible taste in women."
Wyland considered shoving Jesper off the wagon. The dirt road was bordered on each side by what looked like barley and wheat fields, the flat expanses of land dotted occasionally by barns and windmills. The wagon kept up a fast clip. A little too fast, Wyland thought, as they jounced over a deep rut. He hissed in a breath.
"Rains," said the farmer. "No one's got around to laying sand yet."
"That's okay," said Jesper with a wince as the wagon hit another bone-rattling divot in the ground.
"I don't really need my spleen in one piece."
The farmer laughed.
"It's good for you. Jogs the liver."
Wyland clutched his side, wishing he'd shoved Jesper out of the wagon after all and jumped right down with him. Luckily, only a mile later, the wagon slowed before two stone posts that marked a long gravel drive.
"This is as far as I go," said the farmer. "Not a place I want truck with. Too much suffering. Sometimes when the wind blows right, you can hear 'em laughing and shrieking."
Jesper and Wyland exchanged a glance.
"You saying it's haunted?" asked Jesper.
"I suppose."
They said their thanks and gratefully slid down to the ground.
"When you're done here, head up the road a couple miles," said the driver. "I got 2 acres, still need working."
5 kruger a day, and you can sleep in the barn instead of out in the field."
"Sounds promising," said Jesper with a wave, but as they turned to make their way up the road to the church, he grumbled,
"We're walking back. I think I bruised a rib."
When the driver was gone from view, they shrugged out of their coats and caps to reveal the dark suits Kaz had suggested they wear underneath, and tucked them behind a tree stump.
"Tell them you were sent by Cornelis Smeet," Kaz had said, "that you want to make sure the grave is being well maintained for Mr. Van Eck."
"Why?" Wyland had asked.
"Because if you claim to be Jan Van Eck's son, no one is going to believe you."
The road was lined with poplars, and as they crested the hill, a building came into view. 3 stories of white stone, fronted by low, graceful stairs leading to an arched front door. The drive was neatly laid with gravel and bordered by low yew hedges on either side.
"Doesn't look like a church," said Jesper.
"Maybe it used to be a monastery or a school?" Wyland suggested. He listened to the gravel crunch beneath his shoes. "Jesper, do you remember much about your mother?" Wyland had seen a lot of different smiles from Jesper, but the one that spread across his face now was new, slow, and as closely held as a winning hand. All he said was, "Yeah, she taught me to shoot." There were 100 questions Wyland wanted to ask, but the closer they drew to the church, the less he seemed able to capture a thought and hold it. On the left of the building, he could see an arbor covered with new blooming wisteria, the sweet scent of the purple blossoms heavy on the spring air. A little past the church's lawn and to the right, he saw a wrought iron gate and a fence surrounding a graveyard. A tall stone figure at its center, a woman, Wyland guessed. Probably St. Hilda. "That must be the cemetery," Wyland said, clutching his flowers tighter. "What am I doing here?" There was that question again, and suddenly, he didn't know. Kaz had been right. This was stupid. Sentimental. What good would seeing a gravestone with his mother's name on it do? He wouldn't even be able to read it. But they'd come all this way. "Jesper," he began, but at that moment, a woman in gray work clothes rounded the corner, pushing a wheelbarrow mounded with earth.
"Good morning," she called to them. "Can I help you?" "And a fine morning it is," said Jesper smoothly. "We come to you from the offices of Cornelis Smeet."
She frowned, and Wyland added, "On behalf of the esteemed councilman Jan Van Eck." Apparently, she didn't notice the quaver in his voice, because her brow cleared and she smiled. Her cheeks were round and rosy.
"Of course, but I confess to being surprised. Mr. Van Eck has been so generous with us, yet we hear from him so rarely. Nothing's wrong, is it?"
"Not at all," said Wyland. "Just a new policy," said Jesper. "More work for everyone."
"Isn't that always the way?" The woman smiled again. "And I see you brought flowers."
Wyland looked down at the bouquet. It seemed smaller and more straggly than he'd thought.
Yes.
She wiped her hands on her shapeless smock and said,
"I'll take you to her."
But instead of turning in the direction of the graveyard, she headed back toward the entrance. Jesper shrugged, and they followed. As they made their way up the low stone steps, something cold crawled over Wyland's spine.
"Jesper," he whispered, "there are bars on the windows."
"Antsy monks?" Jesper offered, but he was not smiling.
The front parlor was 2 stories high, its floor set with clean white tiles painted with delicate blue tulips. It looked like no church Wyland had ever seen. The hush in the room was so deep it felt almost suffocating. A large desk was placed in the corner, and on it was a vase of the wisteria Wyland had seen outside. He inhaled deeply. The smell was comforting. The woman unlocked a large cabinet and sifted through it for a moment, then removed a thick file.
"Here we are. Maria Hendricks. As you can see, everything is in order. You can have a look while we get her cleaned up. Next time you can avoid a delay if you notify us ahead of your visit."
Wyland felt an icy sweat break out over his body. He managed a nod. The woman removed a heavy key ring from the cabinet and unlocked one of the pale blue doors that led out of the parlor. Wyland heard her turn the key in the lock from the other side. He set the wildflowers down on the desk. Their stems were broken. He'd been clutching them too tightly.
"What is this place?" Weiland said. "What did they mean? Get her cleaned up?" His heart ticked a frantic beat, a metronome set to the wrong rhythm. Jesper was flipping through the folder, his eyes skimming the pages. Weiland leaned over his shoulder and felt a hopeless, choking panic grip him. The words on the page were a meaningless scrawl, a black mess of insect legs. He fought for breath. "Jesper, please," he begged, his voice thin and reedy. "Read it to me."
"I'm sorry," Jesper said hurriedly. "I forgot. I..."
Weiland couldn't make sense of the look on Jesper's face. Sadness, confusion.
"Weiland, I think your mother's alive."
"That's impossible."
"Your father had her committed."
Weiland shook his head. "That couldn't be. She got sick, a lung infection. He states that she's a victim of hysteria, paranoia, and persecution disorder." "She can't be alive. He remarried. What about Alice?"
"I think he had your mother declared insane and used it as grounds for divorce. This isn't a church, Weiland. It's an asylum. Saint Hilda."
His father had been sending them money every year, but not as a charitable donation. For her upkeep. For their silence. The room was suddenly spinning. Jesper pulled him into the chair behind the desk and pressed against Weiland's shoulder blades, urging him forward.
"Put your head between your knees. Focus on the floor. Breathe."
Weiland forced himself to inhale, exhale, to gaze at those charming blue tulips in their white tile boxes. "Tell me the rest."
"You need to calm down, or they're going to know something's wrong."
"Tell me the rest." Jesper blew out a breath and continued to flip through the file.
"Son of a bitch," he said after a minute.
"There's a transfer of authority in the file. It's a copy." Weiland kept his eyes on the tiled floor. "What? What is that?"
Jesper read, "This document, witnessed in the full sight of Gazin, and in keeping with the honest dealings of men, made binding by the courts of Kirch and its merchant council, signifies the transfer of all property, estates, and legal holdings from Maria Hendricks to Jan Van Eck, to be managed by him until Maria Hendricks is once again competent to conduct her own affairs."
"The transfer of all property?" Weiland repeated. "What am I doing here? What am I doing here? What is she doing here?" The key turned in the lock of the pale blue door, and the woman, a nurse, Weiland realized, sailed back through, smoothing the apron of her smock. "We're ready for you," she said. "She's quite docile today. Are you all right?"
"My friend's feeling a bit faint. Too much sun after all those hours in Mr. Smeet's office. Could we trouble you for a glass of water?"
"Certainly," said the nurse. "Oh, you do look a bit done under." She disappeared behind the door again, following the same routine of unlocking and locking it. "She's making sure the patients don't get out." Jesper squatted in front of Weiland and put his hands on his shoulders.
"Why? Listen to me. You have to pull yourself together. Can you do this? We can leave. I can tell her you're not up to it, or I can just go in myself. We can try to come back some..."
Weiland took a deep, shuddering breath through his nose. He couldn't fathom what was happening, couldn't understand the scope of it. "So just do one thing at a time." It was a technique one of his tutors had taught him to try to keep him from getting overwhelmed by the page. It hadn't worked, particularly not when his father was looming over him, but Weiland had managed to apply it elsewhere. "One thing at a time. Stand up." He stood up. "You're fine." "I'm fine," he said. "We are not leaving." It was the one thing he was certain of.
When the nurse returned, he accepted the water glass, thanked her, drank. Then he and Jesper followed her through the pale blue door. He couldn't bring himself to gather the wilting wildflowers scattered on the desk, one thing at a time. They walked past locked doors, some kind of exercise room. From somewhere he heard moaning. In a wide parlor, two women were playing what looked like a game of Ritterspell. "My mother is dead. She's dead." But nothing in him believed it. Not anymore. Finally, the nurse led them to a glassed-in porch that had been located on the west side of the building so it would capture all the warmth of the sun's setting rays. One full wall was composed of windows, and through them the green spill of the hospital's lawn was visible, the graveyard in the distance. It was a pretty room, the tiled floor spotless. A canvas with the beginnings of a landscape emerging from it leaned on an easel by the window. A memory returned to Wylan, his mother standing at an easel in the back garden of the house on Geldstrat, the smell of linseed oil, clean brushes in an empty glass, her thoughtful gaze assessing the lines of the boathouse and the canal beyond. "She paints," Wylan said flatly.
"All the time,"
the nurse said cheerily.
"Quite the artist is our Maria."
A woman sat in a wheeled chair, head dipping as if she was fighting not to doze off, blankets piled up around her narrow shoulders. Her face was lined, her hair, a faded amber, shot through with gray. "The color of my hair," Wylan realized, "if it had been left out in the sun to fade." He felt a surge of relief. This woman was far too old to be his mother. But then her chin lifted and her eyes opened. They were a clear, pure hazel, unchanged, undiminished.
"You have some visitors, Miss Hendricks."
His mother's lips moved, but Wylan couldn't hear what she said. She looked at them with sharp eyes. Then her expression wavered, became vague and questioning, as the certainty left her face.
Should I know you?
Wyland's throat ached. Would you know me, he wondered, if I still looked like your son? He managed a shake of his head.
We met long ago, he said. When I was just a child.
She made a humming noise and looked out at the lawn. Wylan turned helplessly to Jesper. He was not ready for this. His mother was a body long buried, dust in the ground.
Gently, Jesper led him to the chair in front of Maria.
"We have an hour before we have to start the walk back," he said quietly. "Talk to her."
"About what?"
"Remember what you said to Kaz? We don't know what may happen next. This is all we've got." Then he rose and crossed to where the nurse was tidying up the paints.
"Tell me, miss, I'm ashamed to say I didn't catch your name."
The nurse smiled, her cheeks round and red as candied apples.
"Betcha."
"A charming name for a charming girl. Mr. Smeet asked that I have a look at all the facilities while we're here. Would you mind giving me a quick tour?"
She hesitated, glancing over at Wylan.
"We'll be fine here," Wylan managed, in a voice that sounded too loud and too hearty to his ears. "I'll just run through some routine questions, all part of the new policy."
The nurse twinkled at Jesper.
"Well then, I think we might have a quick look around."
Wylan studied his mother, his thoughts a jangle of misplayed chords. They'd cut her hair short. He tried to picture her younger, in the fine black wool gown of a mercher's wife, white lace gathered at her collar, her curls thick and vibrant,
arranged by a lady's maid into a nautilus of braids.
"Hello," he managed. "Did you come for my money? I don't have any money."
"I don't either," Weiland said faintly. She was not familiar, exactly, but there was something in the way she tilted her head, the way she sat, her spine still straight, as if she was at the piano.
"Do you like music?" he asked.
She nodded.
"Yes, but there isn't much here."
He pulled the flute from his shirt. He'd traveled the whole day with it tucked up against his chest like some kind of secret, and it was still warm from his body. He'd planned to play it beside her grave like some kind of idiot. How Kaz would have laughed at him. The first few notes were wobbly, but then he got control of his breath. He found the melody, a simple song, one of the first he'd learned. For a moment, she looked as if she was trying to remember where she might have heard it. Then she simply closed her eyes and listened. When he was finished, she said,
"Play something cheerful."
So he played a Kalish reel and then a Kerch sea shanty that was better suited to the tin whistle. He played every song that came into his head, but nothing mournful, nothing sad. She didn't speak, though occasionally he saw her tap her toe to the music, and her lips would move as if she knew the words. At last he put the flute down in his lap.
"How long have you been here?"
She stayed silent. He leaned forward, seeking some answer in those vague, hazel eyes.
"What did they do to you?"
She laid a gentle hand on his cheek. Her palm felt cool and dry.
"What did they do to you?"
He couldn't tell if it was a challenge or if she was just repeating his words. Weiland felt the painful press of tears in his throat and fought to swallow them. The door banged open.
"Well now, did we have a good visit?" said the nurse as she entered.
Hastily, Weiland tucked the flute back into his shirt.
"Indeed," he said. "Everything seems to be in order."
"You two seem awfully young for this type of work," she said, dimpling at Jesper.
"I might say the same for you," he replied. "But you know how it is. The new clerks get stuck with the most menial tasks."
"Will you be back again soon?"
Jesper winked.
"You never do know,"
he nodded at Weiland. "We have a boat to catch."
"Say goodbye, Miss Hendricks," urged the nurse.
Maria's lips moved, but this time Weiland was close enough to hear what she muttered. Van Eck.
On the way out of the hospital, the nurse kept up a steady stream of chatter with Jesper. Weiland walked behind them. His head hurt. What had his father done to her? Was she truly mad, or had he simply bribed the right people to say so? Had he drugged her? Jesper glanced back at Weiland once as the nurse gibbered on, his gray eyes concerned. They were almost to the pale blue door when the nurse said,
"Would you like to see her paintings?"
Weiland jerked to a halt. He nodded.
"I think that would be most interesting," said Jesper.
The woman led them back the way they'd come and then opened the door to what appeared to be a closet. Weiland felt his knees buckle and had to grab the wall for balance. The nurse didn't notice. She was talking on and on.
"The paints are expensive, of course, but they seem to bring her so much pleasure. This is just the latest batch. Every 6 months or so, we have to put them on the rubbish heap. There just isn't space for them."
Weiland wanted to scream. The closet was crammed with paintings. Landscapes, different views of the hospital grounds, a lake in sun and shadow, and there, repeated again and again, was the face of a little boy with ruddy curls and bright blue eyes. He must have made some kind of noise, because the nurse turned to him. "Oh, dear," she said to Jesper, "your friend's gone quite pale again. Perhaps a stimulant?"
"No, no," said Jesper, putting his arm around Wylan, "but we really should be going. It's been a most enlightening visit."
Wylan didn't register the walk down the drive, bordered by yew hedges, or retrieving their coats and caps from behind the tree stump near the main road. They were halfway back to the dock before he could bring himself to speak. "She knows what he did to her. She knows he had no right to take her money, her life." "Van Eck," she'd said.
She was not Maria Hendricks. She was Maria Van Eck, a wife and mother stripped of her name and her fortune.
"Remember when I said he wasn't evil?" Wyland's legs gave out, and he sat down hard right there in the middle of the road, and he couldn't bring himself to care because the tears were coming, and there was no way he could stop them. They gusted through his chest in ragged, ugly sobs. He hated that Jesper was seeing him cry, but there was nothing he could do, not about the tears, not about any of it. He buried his face in his arms, covering his head as if, were he to only will it strongly enough, he could vanish. He felt Jesper squeeze his arm.
"It's okay," Jesper said.
"No, it's not."
"You're right, it's not. It's rotten, and I'd like to string your father up in a barren field and let the vultures have at him."
Wylan shook his head. "You don't understand. It was me. I caused this. He wanted a new wife. He wanted an heir, a real heir, not a moron who can barely spell his own name."
He'd been 8 when his mother had been sent away. He didn't have to wonder anymore. That was when his father had given up on him.
"Hey," Jesper said, giving him a shake. "Hey. Your father could have made a lot of choices when he found out you couldn't read. Hell, he could have said you were blind or that you had trouble with your vision. Or better yet, he could have just been happy about the fact that he had a genius for a son."
"I'm not a genius."
"You're stupid about a lot of things, Wylan, but you are not stupid.
And if I ever hear you call yourself a moron again, I'm going to tell Matthias you tried to kiss Nina with tongue."
Wylan wiped his nose on his sleeve. "He'll never believe it."
"Then I'll tell Nina you tried to kiss Matthias with tongue."
He sighed. "Look, Wylan, normal people don't wall their wives up in insane asylums. They don't disinherit their sons because they didn't get the child they wanted. You think my dad wanted a mess like me for a kid? You didn't cause this. This happened because your father is a lunatic dressed up in a quality suit." Wylan pressed the heels of his hands to his swollen eyes. "That's all true. And none of it makes me feel any better." Jesper gave his shoulder another little shake.
"Well, how about this? Kaz is going to tear your father's damn life apart."
Wylan was about to say that didn't help either, but he hesitated.
Kaz Brekker was the most brutal, vengeful creature Wylan had ever encountered, and he'd sworn he was going to destroy Jan Van Eck.
The thought felt like cool water cascading over the hot, shameful feeling of helplessness he'd been carrying with him for so long. Nothing could make this right. Ever. But Kaz could make his father's life very wrong. And Wylan would be rich. He could take his mother from this place. They could go somewhere warm. He could put her in front of a piano, get her to play, take her somewhere full of bright colors and beautiful sounds. They could go to Novi Zem. They could go anywhere. Wylan lifted his head and wiped away his tears.
"Actually, that helps a lot."
Jesper grinned.
"Thought it might.
But if we don't get on that boat back to Ketterdam, no righteous comeuppance." Wylan rose, suddenly eager to return to the city to help bring Kaz's plan to life. He'd gone to the ice court reluctantly. He'd aided Kaz grudgingly, because through all of it, he'd believed that he deserved his father's contempt, and now he could admit that somewhere, in some buried place, he'd hoped there might still be a way back to his father's good favor. Well, his father could keep that good favor and see what it bought him when Kaz Brekker was finished. "Come on," he said. "Let's go steal all my dad's money."
"Isn't it your money?"
"Okay. Let's go steal it back." They headed off at a run.
"I love a little righteous comeuppance," said Jesper. "Jogs the liver."
15. Matthias. A crowd had gathered outside the tavern, drawn by the sounds of breaking glass and trouble. Zoya lowered Nina and Matthias none too gently to the floor, and they were herded quickly out of the back of the tavern, surrounded by a small segment of the armed men. The rest remained in the tavern to offer whatever explanations could be given for the fact that a bunch of bones had just flown through the marketplace and shattered the building's windows. Matthias wasn't even sure he understood what had happened. Had Nina controlled those false saints' relics? Had it been something else altogether? And why had they been attacked? Matthias thought they would emerge into an alley, but instead, they descended a series of ancient-looking steps into a dank tunnel. The old canal, Matthias realized, as they climbed aboard a boat that passed soundlessly through the dark. It had been paved over, but not entirely filled in. They were traveling beneath the broad thoroughfare that fronted the embassy. Only a few moments later, Zoya led them up a narrow metal ladder and into a bare room with a ceiling so low, Matthias had to bend double. Nina said something to Zoya in Ravkin, and then translated Zoya's reply for Matthias.
"It's a half-room. When the embassy was built, they created a false floor 4 feet above the original floor. The way it's set into the foundation, it's almost impossible to know there's another room beneath you."
"It's little more than a crawl space."
"Yes, but Ketterdam's buildings don't have basements, so no one would even think to search below."
It seemed an extreme precaution in what was supposed to be a neutral city, but perhaps the Ravkins had been forced to take extreme measures to protect their citizens. "Because of people like me." Matthias had been a hunter, a killer, and proud to do his job well. A moment later, they came upon a group of people huddled together against what Matthias thought might be the eastern wall if he hadn't gotten completely turned around.
"We're under the embassy garden," said Nina.
He nodded. This would be the safest place to keep a group of people if you didn't want to risk voices rising through the embassy floor. There were about 15 of them, all ages and colors. They seemed to have little in common beyond their wary expressions, but Matthias knew they must all be Grisha. They hadn't needed Nina's warning to seek sanctuary.
"So few?" Matthias said.
Nina had estimated the number of Grisha in the city to be closer to 30.
"Maybe the others got out on their own, or are just lying low."
Or perhaps they'd already been captured. If Nina did not wish to speak the possibility, he wouldn't either. Zoya led them through an archway to an area where Matthias was relieved to be able to stand upright. Given the round shape of the room, he suspected they were beneath some kind of false cistern, or maybe a folly in the garden. His relief dissolved when one of Zoya's armed men produced a pair of shackles, and Zoya pointed directly at Matthias. Immediately, Nina stepped in front of him, and she and Zoya began arguing in furious whispers. Matthias knew exactly who he was dealing with. Zoya Nazielenski was one of the most powerful witches in Ravka. She was a legendary squaller. A soldier who had served first the Darkling, then the Sun Summoner, and who had ascended to power as a member of King Nikolai's Grisha Triumvirate. Now that he'd experienced a taste of her abilities for himself, he wasn't surprised at how quickly she'd risen. The argument was entirely in Ravkin, and Matthias didn't understand a word of it, but the scorn in Zoya's voice was obvious, as were her jabbing gestures toward Matthias and the shackles. He was ready to growl that if the Storm Witch wanted him locked up, she could try doing it herself and see what happened, when Nina held up her hands.
"No more," she said in Kurch. "Matthias remains free, and we continue this conversation in a language we all understand. He has a right to know what's going on."
Zoya's eyes narrow. She looked from Matthias to Nina, and then, in heavily accented Kurch, she said,
"Nina Zenik, you are still a soldier of the Second Army, and I am still your commanding officer. You are directly disobeying orders."
"Then you'll just have to put me in chains, too."
"Don't think I'm not considering it."
"Nina!"
The cry came from a red-headed girl who had appeared in the echoing room.
"Jenya!"
Nina whooped, but Matthias would have known this woman without any introduction. Her face was covered in scars, and she wore a red silk eye patch embroidered with a golden sunburst. Jenya Safran, the renowned tailor, Nina's former instructor, and another member of the Triumvirate. As Matthias watched them embrace, he felt sick. He'd expected to meet a group of anonymous Grisha, people who had taken refuge in Ketterdam and then found themselves alone and in danger. People like Nina, not Ravka's highest-ranking Grisha. All his instincts called on him to fight or be gone from this place as fast as possible, not to stand there like a suitor meeting his beloved's parents. And yet, these were Nina's friends, her teachers. "They're the enemy," said a voice in his head, and he wasn't sure if it was Commander Broom's or his own. Jenya stepped back, brushing the blonde strands from Nina's wig from her face to get a better look at her.
"Nina, how is this possible? The last time Zoya saw you..."
"You were throwing a tantrum," said Zoya, "stomping away from camp with all the caution of a wayward moose."
To Matthias's surprise, Nina actually winced like a child taking a scolding. He didn't think he'd ever seen her embarrassed before.
"We thought you were dead,"
Jenya said.
"She looks half dead."
"She looks fine."
"You vanished," Zoya spat. "When we heard there were Fjerdens nearby, we feared the worst."
"The worst happened,"
Nina said.
"And then it happened some more."
She took Matthias's hand.
"But we're here now."
Zoya glared at their clasped hands and crossed her arms.
"I see."
Jenya raised an auburn brow.
"Well, if he's the worst that can happen..."
"What are you doing here?"
Zoya demanded.
"Are you and your Fjerden accessory trying to get out of Ketterdam?"
"What if we were? Why did you ambush us?"
"There have been attacks on Grisha all over the city. We didn't know who you were, or if you might be colluding with the Shoe. Only that you use the code of the Peddler. We always station soldiers in the tavern now. Anyone looking for Grisha is a potential threat."
Given what Matthias had seen of the new Shoe soldiers, they were right to be wary.
"We came to offer our help," Nina said.
"What kind of help? You have no idea what forces are at work here, Nina. The Shoe have developed a drug.
Judah Parem."
"What do you know about Parem?"
Nina squeezed Matthias's hand. She took a deep breath.
"I've seen it used. I've experienced it myself."
Jenya's single amber eye widened.
"Oh, Nina, no, you didn't."
"Of course she did," said Zoya. "You've always been like this. You sink into trouble like it's a warm bath. Is this why you look like second-day gruel? How could you take a risk like that, Nina?"
"I do not look like gruel,"
Nina protested, but she had that same chastened look on her face. Matthias couldn't stand it. "She did it to save our lives," he said. "She did it knowing she might be dooming herself to misery and even death."
"Reckless," Zoya declared.
"Zoya," said Jenya, "we don't know the circumstances."
"We know that she's been missing nearly a year,"
she pointed an accusing finger at Nina.
"And now she shows up with a Fjerden in tow, one built like a soldier and who uses Druskala fighting techniques."
Zoya reached into her pocket and pulled out a handful of bones.
"She attacked our soldiers with these, with bone shards, Jenya. Have you ever heard of such a thing being possible?"
Jenya stared at the bones and then at Nina.
Is this true?
Nina pressed her lips together.
Possibly?
Possibly, said Zoya. And you're telling me we should just trust her?
Jenya looked less certain, but said,
I'm telling you we should listen.
All right, said Zoya. I wait with open ears and a ready heart. Entertain me, Nina Zenik.
Matthias knew what it was to face the mentors you had idolized, to feel yourself become a nervous pupil again, yearning to please. He turned to Nina and said in Fjärden, Do not let them cow you. You are not the girl you were. You are not just a soldier to command.
So why do I feel like finding a corner to sob in?
This is a round room. There are no corners.
Matthias,
remember what we've been through. Remember what we came here for.
I thought we were all speaking Kurch, said Zoya.
Nina gave Matthias's hand another squeeze, threw back her head, and said,
I was taken captive by the Druska. Matthias helped me escape. Matthias was taken captive by the Kurch. I helped him escape. I was taken captive by Jarl Brum. Matthias helped me escape.
Matthias wasn't entirely comfortable with how good they both were at being taken prisoner.
Jarl Brum?
Zoya said in horror. Nina sighed.
It's been a rough year. I swear I'll explain it all to you, and if you decide I should be put in a sack and dropped in the Sokol River, I will go with a minimum of wailing. But we came here tonight because we saw the Kurgood soldiers attack on West Dave. I want to help get these Grisha out of the city before the shoe find them.
Zoya had to be several inches shorter than Nina, but she still managed to look down her nose when she said,
And how can you help?
We have a ship.
That wasn't technically true, but Matthias wasn't going to argue. Zoya waved a dismissive hand.
We have a ship, too. It's stuck miles off the coast. The harbor has been blockaded by the Kurch and the Council of Tides. No foreign vessel can come or go without express permission from a member of the Merchant Council.
So Kaz had been right. Vanek was using every bit of his influence with the government to ensure Kaz didn't get Kuwei out of Ketterdam.
Sure, said Nina, but our ship belongs to a member of the Kurch Merchant Council.
Zoya and Jenya exchanged a glance.
All right, Zenik, said Zoya. Now I'm listening.
Nina filled in some of the details for Zoya and Jenya, though Matthias noticed that she did not mention Kuwei, and that she steered very clear from any talk of the Ice Court. When they went upstairs to debate the proposal, they left Nina and Matthias behind, two armed guards posted at the entry to the cistern room. In Fjärden, Matthias whispered,
If Ravka's spies are worth their salt, your friends are going to realize we were the ones who broke out Kuwei.
Don't whisper,
Nina replied in Fjärden, but in a normal tone of voice.
It will just make the guards suspicious. And I'll tell Zoya and Jenya everything eventually. But remember how keen we were on killing Kuwei? I'm not sure Zoya would make the same choice to spare him. At least, not until he's safely on Ravkin soil. She doesn't need to know who's on that boat until it docks in Oskurvo.
Safely on Ravkin soil. The words sat heavy in Matthias's gut. He was eager to get Nina out of the city, but nothing about the prospect of going to Ravka seemed safe to him. Nina must have sensed his unease, because she said,
Ravka is the safest place for Kuwei. He needs our protection.
Just what does Zoya Nazielenski's protection look like?
She's really not that bad.
Matthias shot her a skeptical look.
Actually, she's terrible. But she and Jenya saw a lot of death in the Civil War. I don't believe they want more bloodshed.
Matthias hoped that was true, but even if it was, he wasn't sure it would matter.
Do you remember what you said to me, Nina? You wished King Nikolai would march north and raise everything in his path.
I was angry.
You had a right to your anger. We all do. That's the problem. Brum won't stop. The Druskala won't stop. They consider it their holy mission to destroy your kind.
It had been his mission, too, and he could still feel the distrust, the pull toward hatred. He cursed himself for it.
Then we'll find a way to change their minds, all of them.
She studied him a moment.
You used a dusk bomb today. Did you have Wylan make it?
Yes, he admitted.
Why?
He'd known she wouldn't like it. I wasn't sure how the Parem would affect your power. If I had to keep you from the drug, I needed to be able to fight you without hurting you.
And you brought it today in case we had trouble?
Yes.
With Grisha?
He nodded, waiting for her admonishment. But all she did was watch him, her face thoughtful. She drew nearer. Matthias cast an uneasy glance at the guards' backs, visible through the doorway.
Ignore them, she said. Why haven't you kissed me, Matthias?
This isn't the time.
Is it because of what I am? Is it because you still fear me?
No. She paused, and he could see her struggling with what she wanted to say.
Is it because of the way I behaved on the ship? The way I acted the other night? When I tried to get you to give me the rest of the Parem?
How can you think that?
You're always calling me shameless. I guess I am ashamed.
She shuddered.
It's like wearing a coat that doesn't fit.
Nina, I gave you my oath.
But...
Your enemies are my enemies, and I will stand with you against any foe, including this accursed drug. She shook her head as if he were speaking nonsense.
I don't want you to be with me because of an oath, or because you think you need to protect me, or because you think you owe me some stupid blood debt.
Nina, he started, then stopped. Nina, I am with you because you let me be with you. There is no greater honor than to stand by your side.
Honor, duty, I get it.
Her temper he could bear, but her disappointment was unacceptable. Matthias knew only the language of war. He did not have the words for this. Meeting you was a disaster. She raised a brow.
Thank you.
Jell, he was terrible at this. He stumbled on, trying to make her understand. But I am grateful every day for that disaster. I needed a cataclysm to shake me from the life I knew. You were an earthquake. Landslide. She said, planting a hand on her hip.
Am a delicate flower.
You aren't a flower. You're every blossom in the wood blooming at once. You're a tidal wave. You're a stampede. You are overwhelming.
And what would you prefer?
She said, eyes blazing, the slightest quiver to her voice.
A proper Fjärden girl, who wears high collars and dunks herself in cold water whenever she has the urge to do something exciting?
That isn't what I meant. She sidled closer to him. Again, his eyes strayed to the guards. Their backs were turned, but Matthias knew they must be listening, no matter what language he and Nina were speaking.
What are you so afraid of?
She challenged.
Don't look at them, Matthias. Look at me.
He looked. It was a struggle not to look. He loved seeing her in Fjärden clothes. The little woolly vest, the full sweep of her skirts. Her green eyes were bright, her cheeks pink, her lips slightly parted. It was easy to imagine himself kneeling like a penitent before her, letting his hands slide up the white curves of her calves, pushing those skirts higher, past her knees, to the warm skin of her thighs. And the worst part was that he knew how good she would feel. Every cell in his body remembered the press of her naked body that first night in the whaling camp. There is no one I want more. There is nothing I want more than to be overwhelmed by you.
But you don't want to kiss me?
He inhaled slowly, trying to bring order to his thoughts. This was all wrong. In Fjärda, he began.
We're not in Fjärda.
He needed to make her understand. In Fjärda, he persisted. I would have asked your parents for permission to walk out with you.
I haven't seen my parents since I was a child.
We would have been chaperoned. I would have dined with your family at least 3 times before we were ever left alone together.
We are alone together now, Matthias.
I would have brought you gifts. Nina tipped her head to one side.
Go on.
Winter roses, if I could afford them. A silver comb for your hair.
I don't need those things.
Apple cakes with sweet cream.
I thought Druskella didn't eat sweets.
They'd all be for you, he said.
You have my attention.
Our first kiss would be in a sunlit wood or under a starry sky after a village dance, not in a tomb or some dank basement with guards at the door.
Let me get this straight, Nina said. You haven't kissed me because the setting isn't suitably romantic?
This isn't about romance. A proper kiss, a proper courtship. There's a way these things should be